Hi, this is Melissa Mason bringing you another PEDX podcast from the New Mexico Pediatric Society. Today's PEDX podcast is a special one, and I am going to have Julia Hecht, who is our guest today, give you a little bit of information about the podcast as well as an introduction. So, Julia, let me turn it over to you.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks. It's great to be here with you today. So I am a New Mexico pediatrician. I came here from New York to do my residency training at UNM Hospital, and I practiced primary care at Young Children's Health Center in the International District, and also as the medical director and school doctor at the New Mexico School for the Deaf in Santa Fe. I retired from clinical practice about 10 years ago, and I describe myself as semi-retired because I no longer see patients, but I do keep busy using my past clinical experience in public health and on the national and state level regarding early hearing detection and intervention. And what I'm going to talk about today is the result of work I've done on a telehealth grant that our chapter, the New Mexico Pediatric Society, received from the American Academy of Pediatrics.
So I understand there is a statement that you have to read before we continue. Before you do that, I will also just say that I would not describe the volume of work that you do as being semi-retired. So really excited about this work that you've done and looking forward to hearing more. So let's hear the official statement.
Well, thank you. And basically, the statement is as follows. This podcast was supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as part of an award totaling $6 million with no percentage financed with non-governmental sources. The contents are those of the New Mexico Pediatric Society and do not necessarily represent the official views of nor an endorsement by HRSA, HHS, or the U.S. government.
All right, we're official, so now we can move on to the fun part. So I know today you're going to talk to all of us about the intersection of telehealth and cultural safety. How did you become interested in this and what you'll be talking about today?
Well, I've always been interested in language and culture. I got my bachelor's degree in anthropology. And when I was in practice, I really enjoyed serving communities where other languages and cultures predominated, such as American Sign Language and the Deaf culture, and also Spanish and the Mexican culture. Over the past 2 years, I've been working with a grassroots coalition of providers of both pediatrics and audiology to set up what's called teleaudiology services. That would be audiology via telehealth in Gallup, New Mexico. And as you know, in our rural state, many areas don't have pediatric specialty care and have to travel really long distances to Albuquerque. The goal of this project was to be able to bring pediatric audiology to families who live in very rural areas of the Navajo Nation. So I started thinking about what this means for both the providers and the families from a cultural perspective. And this led me to apply for that AAP telehealth grant in 2021. Honestly, I didn't know anything about the topic of cultural safety, and I hadn't even heard the term until I started doing the work of the grant.
Yeah, I know that, and I'll let you in on a secret here. Julie and I sometimes go for walks, and we had started talking about this, and I had never heard that term cultural safety until you had really started to talk to me about that. So can you tell more about what is cultural safety and how does that relate to telehealth and how does that relate to this grant?
Well, there are a lot of definitions of cultural safety, it turns out, but one that I really like came from a group in New Zealand led by Peter Crampton, and it is cultural safety focuses on the potential differences between health providers and patients that have an impact on care, and it aims to minimize any assault on the patient's cultural identity.
That assault, that's a big word.
Yeah, it is. And it occurred to me while I was working on this initiative that the providers in Albuquerque were going to be caring for patients and families who live remotely. And I was wondering, what do we need to understand about these remote tribal communities and about Navajo culture to make sure the services like make sense from a cultural perspective? Mm-hmm. So like what cultural information do providers need to know to be able to just do a good job for the patients? So that's why I applied for the grant, because I thought this would be a great opportunity for me to be able to fund my time and others in order to gather information on this topic. And I called the grant at the time, the project, Providing Culturally Meaningful Care for Navajo Children and Youth with Special Healthcare Needs. My partners were a family-to-family health information organization called Navajo Family Voices, and also Children's Medical Services at the Department of Health. And I assumed that I could have focus groups, and I was really excited about sourcing the information directly from families about what they wanted physicians to know regarding their cultural needs. Mm-hmm. I was actually going to have these groups and ask them directly. But when I started working on the grant activity, I discovered right away that I had jumped the gun and that I needed to work on this topic of what's called cultural safety before I could even embark on the work to understand more about specific Navajo cultural practices or ways of thinking.
So it's interesting because I find in a lot of, you know, personally speaking, and also a lot of people's experience is what you get when you thought you were going to get something else. And so you start this idea of, I'm going to work on this. But then the more you know, you realize I have to take a few steps back and reshift my focus. So can you tell me more about what happened, why you didn't just move ahead with the focus groups as you had planned?
Sure. It's a good question. Well, a turning point for me was my experience with the Navajo Nation, what we call an IRB, and they call the Human Research Review Board. The executive director at my partner organization, Navajo Family Voices, her name is Josie Fu, and she told me that I had to speak to someone from the Navajo Nation Human Research Review Board to get permission for everything that I wanted to do.
Wow.
Yeah, even though I wasn't planning on publishing this, and really I was just using this to instruct us on better practice and maybe create an educational module for my colleagues about doing this, it still required me to go through this process. So I had about a half-hour phone conversation with a gentleman at that office, and he basically told me that I was not permitted to have any direct contact with families or to question any members of the Navajo Nation to collect the information I wanted, even like friends of mine who live in Albuquerque, that all of the questioning would have to be done through Navajo individuals who are the staff at Navajo Family Voices. So he said basically that this was so that the tribe could be protected from me. That was his exact expression, they need to be protected from you. And I thought, wow. In my mind, I'm trying to do something that I think is good and helpful, and I'm being treated as if I'm dangerous and people need to be protected from me. And that was a very powerful and humbling conversation.
Yeah, why? Like, why was that his knee-jerk response to you thinking, I'm going to do something good here?
Well, it did. It stopped me dead in my tracks, and I really had to think about that. Well, I realize that this has apt applications for telehealth because while telehealth is beneficial in many ways, it also brings together providers and patients who might not be familiar with each other's culture or lifestyle. And so that interaction has the potential to be alienating for the patient or even dangerous. So going back to that definition that I shared earlier about cultural safety, where the goal is to minimize any assault on the patient's cultural identity. So I guess just in my questioning, I had the potential to be doing that, to be assaulting people's cultural identity just through my idea of what a helpful focus group could be, might actually be an assault to them. So I think cultural safety has to begin with recognizing that in our own attempt to do good, we may actually be assaulting or endangering someone inadvertently through our own ignorance or lack of awareness. I guess that's a good answer to your question.
Yeah. So, I mean, that would make sense why he felt that he had to protect those people from something that in your mind you thought was a good thing.
That's right.
Yeah. So what are some of the important points of the discussions that have been taking place with you and other people?
Well, interestingly, that definition came from a publication in 2003. And so there have been a lot of discussions about this topic. And one of the important points I learned is that we're not going to become culturally safe practitioners overnight. Now, this is an ongoing process, but it has to start somewhere. So really, the willingness to look at ourselves as individuals in our own professional work is the key to making a start. And we know that with respect to pediatrics, cultural competence is a component of the medical home. Mm-hmm. And research looking at lack of cultural competence has shown that it isn't due to a lack of knowledge, but rather a lack of practitioner self-awareness. So we can think of cultural safety as a basic component of cultural competence, something that we've all been trained to desire and to strive for. Becoming safer requires a commitment to change our attitudes and our behaviors, and this takes some active engagement on ourselves as individuals.
Yeah, it's, of course, no one sets out to do harm, but how often do we stop and take a step back and really evaluate how we interact with people? And is that the best, most appropriate way to do so? I mean, I think we get ingrained in doing our day-to-day and we're busy and we don't really think about it so much. So this is, I think, really important to bring this up, to get the awareness increased and help people be able to understand how to actually become better at this and to pay attention to it and to try to make a change. So knowing that, how did that affect your grant project?
Well, right off the bat, I learned, one, that I could be a danger to the families that I had hoped to talk with. And I think accepting that was really hard, but necessary, because yeah. I didn't want to see myself as a potentially dangerous person, yeah. right? And two, that I was basically a beginner embarking on a journey to develop an understanding of what is cultural safety. So when it came to the grant, I had to change both the goal and the methodology. So rather than hold focus groups, I did a deep dive on the topic by doing a lot of background reading for the context and the history of the Navajo Nation, and also the history of the relationship between government doctors and the Navajo Nation going back as far as 1863.
Just a few years back.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, that's when it started. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, I think because non-Native practitioners may come to clinical encounters feeling that we're starting with a clean slate, it's a neutral encounter, mm-hmm. I'm just meeting this family. But for Navajo individuals and Indigenous people in general, it's not a neutral encounter. That was something that I had to learn. There's a historical context, and perhaps we have the privilege to ignore it, but it's very much present for them.
Yeah.
This is what I was taught. And in doing this research, I also participated in Zoom meetings of organizations and coalitions that were related to child health on the Navajo Nation. I started reading the Navajo Times newspaper to see, you know, what are the current relevant topics and how are Navajo reporters talking about this and how are the people talking about this, these issues. I watched some YouTube videos that were really for cultural education, and there is a great webinar educational series out of Canada on Indigenous cultural safety. And that was very helpful to me. And I did begin working with Navajo Family Voices directly. And we had a focus group with the Navajo Family Voices staff. And I had a dialogue with two of the staff members who are elders. So that was also a new experience for me and also really educational. You know, from our conversations, taking our walks together, that it was a struggle for me how to process all this information that I was collecting and how to present it. So I'm just really glad that you suggested that we discuss it in this podcast.
Well, I am so amazed and impressed with how dedicated you have been to learning more, not just from our typical sources of information, but sources that you wouldn't necessarily think of initially, and to be able to talk to people, and especially with two elders, I mean, that's what a privilege to be able to access those people and to get that information, in addition to all of the other work that you did, I think is wonderful. And I'm glad that you're sharing this with us. So I'm glad it worked out to have this conversation to get this information out and shared in a way that is hopefully not sensitive or wouldn't cause harm to anybody. But getting back to, you know, sensitive information, you said you felt like some of this material was really sensitive. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's right. And even talking about it now, I have some trepidation because, you know, I don't want to be offensive. And when you're talking about another group's history, it feels really weighty and a tremendous responsibility. And so I hope that I do a good job of it. I really feel that the history of the Navajo people after European contact, and specifically the history of the medical doctors for us, is something that is really important to understand. It helped me shift my perspective and get oriented. And it's sensitive because it is a very violent and painful story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I understand learning about it. You want to share some of that, but in a way that doesn't continue to cause harm for people.
Exactly.
So what of that history, having gotten all of that information and digested it, is there any of that history that you feel is really important to share today?
Well, I think as Western medicine practitioners, we have a rather dark origin story when it comes to the Navajo Nation, but I do think it's important to understand that history and the through line into the present. So what I think it's important for us to understand is that when the American military first encountered Navajo people in 1846, they describe them in their journals and in reports as being healthy, industrious, strong, and well-fed. They had numerous herds of cattle and sheep. They had crops of corn and wheat and vegetables, and they lived in comfort and abundance. And they noted that they had a lack of serious medical problems. They had their own system of health and wellness, and it worked. And that's not necessarily what we think about today. Mm-hmm. And through American military policy and escalating tensions, this way of life was encroached upon and limited, and then the attempt was made to fully destroy it. And that culminated with a scorched earth invasion and with the slaughter of cattle and sheep and the burning of food stores and crops. And then when the people were compelled by starvation, they were led on a forced expulsion from their land to the Bosque Redondo, which we know as Fort Sumner. And they were interned there, where they were separated from their land and their ceremonies and their ways of health and wellness. And it was on this march that we know as the Long Walk that they first encountered military doctors. The main mission of these physicians was to separate the people from their traditional healing practices. And thousands of Navajo became ill and died during the march and the internment. So when it comes to the history of the Navajo people, the original role of physicians was actually that of agents of cultural destruction and purveyors of illness and death.
That's horrifying and very dark. And I mean, I know clearly things have changed, not 100%, but it's not like that. So what have you found in your research that shows that things are at least hopefully heading the right direction?
Well, it's true. It's really dark. And it was shocking to me. I had never learned the details of this. And one of the things that crossed my mind is, like, how shocking is this to Navajo people, this history? I mean, specifically when it comes down to physicians. Mm-hmm. And I know that the history of the Long Walk and the internment is like very profound for even Navajo today. This didn't happen that long ago, and it really, it may be shocking to us, but it's a well-known to them as has partly, to a large extent, shaped them into mm-hmm. the people that they are today, resilient people, but also with this, you know, very traumatic history at the hands of the American government. And I wonder, like, how much of this history with doctors is showing up in clinical encounters today. We might not be thinking about it, but I have to assume that after learning about this, that in some way, even maybe unconsciously, it is. And when I think about the gentleman from the Navajo Nation Human Research Review Board, I don't think that he was considering me a danger based on the events of the 19th century.
Right.
I don't think that at all. But I think that it forced me to question, what did he mean by, you know, the tribe has to be protected from me? So I started to look for an example of this legacy in current pediatric practice.
Well, I know based on our discussions and, you know, being from different parts of the country, interestingly, we had the same example. So what was your example of something that is pretty current?
Yeah, I didn't have to think long and hard about it. I just thought back to what was I taught in medical school about Navajo people. And really, I went to medical school in New York. It's where I'm from. And there was really only one thing that I was taught. And it was on my orthopedic elective rotation. There was a day of pediatric orthopedics. And I was taught that basically, the way it was described to me was Navajo parents, and this is current, that Navajo parents are potentially causing damage to their children's hips by using cradle boards. And it was really said as like a piece of valuable information that, you know, if you only had a day to impart information to me about pediatric orthopedics, let's make sure to include that. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because I was moving to New Mexico, because nobody knew at that point that it was even going into pediatrics or moving to New Mexico. So this is information that was basically taught to everyone.
Yeah. And I don't recall if it was in medical school or residency training, but I was taught the same thing, that those babies are at higher risk of hip dysplasia, that you have to counsel the parents on being careful about limiting the number of hours in, you know, a cradle board because of that. I mean, and that wasn't that long ago. But why do you think that this is still happening?
Well, interestingly, from the research that I did, I went back and I looked at what was the data. And it looks like, you know, before there was a Navajo Nation Human Research Review Board, there were some practitioners back in the 60s who decided that they would survey the hips of infants, Navajo infants. And they did x-rays on like a consecutive large number, hundreds of Navajo infants living in this one particular area, and found a high rate of congenital hip dysplasia, as was you could determine by x-ray. Mm. And this was around the time that the Pavlik harness had come into use, which I think was in the 50s, which we know is a treatment. So I don't know exactly the thought process, but I can only imagine that, you know, we had this new treatment and it was pretty easy to use, relatively speaking. It wasn't invasive. And let's go check out whether we should be using this and who we should be using this on the Navajo Nation. And because there was this high rate of hip dysplasia, and because it was now an easy intervention, relatively speaking, basically families were offered treatment with the Pavlik harness. But these were traditional families. This was back in the early 60s, and they all rejected it because they were going to continue with their cradle boards. Mm-hmm. But over time, other studies showed that there was a high rate of hip arthritis and a continued higher. It's still a low rate. It's like instead of being 1.5% prevalence, there's like a 6% prevalence. So it's fourfold higher rate but it's not common. Mm-hmm. It's still 6%. And so there was still this ongoing belief system in Western medicine that the cradle boards were the cause of this. So I think that's part of how this thinking came about. And the idea was, you know, for the good of the Navajo infants, counsel parents not to use cradle boards so that we can get their hip dysplasia rate down to the just the general rate.
Yeah. Well, I will say that despite having that same experience in training, I did witness something that at the time I was pretty amazed by. So I was in the pediatric intensive care unit, and there was a child who was very sick, and the family asked if they could bring in a traditional healer, and they wanted to perform some ceremonial treatments. And before that point, there had been a lot of kind of adversity between the staff and the family, just a lot of defensiveness on both sides. And then they were asking to do this. And I feel like walls were put up that, no, you know, that doesn't have a place here. But we were able to sit down with the family and the treating staff and talk about, well, what exactly do they want to do? So aside from not allowing anything combustible in the room because of the oxygen, the family was able to bring in those treatments and a healer and do those things that they felt were really important. And those were things that they could do for their child. And what I found after that point, really the dynamic between the family and the staff and the treating providers really changed, because I think they were able to be heard, and they also heard why there were some things that we wouldn't allow. I mean, aside from fire, everything else was pretty safe in the ICU. But it really did shift the dynamic in how the family and the staff were able to work together for the good of that child. And so that was something I was really impressed by, and I felt kind of lucky, actually, to have witnessed. So in getting back to this idea of cultural safety, how do we do better? So how do we take that first step in doing a better job with this? Because I like, it's one thing to talk about an issue, but I like to be a fixer. I like fixing things. I want to make it better. So tell me, what do I do? What's a good first step?
Well, I think there are different levels that we can take steps. And I think one of the things that I discovered in my own exploration of the issue of cradle boards and the hip dysplasia was that researchers actually went back and looked at the record and tried to find these children who had been identified as having hip dysplasia, and the families rejected treatment. And these researchers went back to find these families and find out how they were doing now that they were in middle age. Mm-hmm. And what they found out was that none of them had gone on to have hip dislocations. They were able to find, I think, 10 of the 18, so a little more than half.
Pretty good.
Yeah. And so obviously we don't have follow-up on everybody, but what they found was that the prognosis that had been expected of this population was not actually realized, and that nobody, and they were in middle age now, nobody had arthritis. Everybody was fully functional. Some people on x-rays, because they went through the Human Research Review Board, which now existed, yeah, these adults agreed to have x-rays. And while there was some hip dysplasia seen on the x-rays, it didn't actually have any functional importance for them in their current life. And so the idea that all of these families were counseled to be separated from their cultural practice and were told, don't use cradle boards. And in the end, all the ones that were found were doing fine, which if you look at the previous data, very few of them were, based on the prevalence of progression to worsening dysplasia, dislocation, arthritis. It should have been that many more of them did not do well. Instead, all the ones that were found were doing well. I hope I'm explaining that clearly.
Yeah. Yeah. So what we thought we were suggesting as a good treatment, and we're going to help you, and they refused the help, and it turns out they didn't need it in the first place.
Right. At least those patients, mm-hmm, did not. And So I think on one level, you know, researchers can do good by questioning some of these beliefs that we have and rectifying the record. The other thing that was really interesting that I discovered, because, you know, I thought that I knew all I needed to know about hip dysplasia before I did this grant project, based on just my training and my clinical practice, you know, I never knew that the pelvic harness came with its own risks. I never knew that all abduction therapy runs a risk of osteonecrosis, and that there's also a risk of probably temporary, but femoral nerve palsy. I also didn't know that cradle boards were not just carriers, that there is a lot of cultural significance to them, and that there is a lot of cultural benefits that are part of the Navajo belief system. But there are also benefits that in the 70s, when there was a more friendly look at cradle boards from child development psychologists, they actually found that the cradle boards were very helpful for self-regulation, for sleep, for safety. There are a lot of benefits to cradle boards. And there was even a period in the 70s where non-Native people were building cradle boards and putting their babies in them. Wow. And so what it shows us is that our view is really shaped by our cultural lenses. And I think going back to your question, I know I've said a lot, but getting back to your question about what we can do, we can start to notice our own cultural lenses in which we're viewing other people. And we can recognize that often in medicine, we think of ourselves as neutral and the medical world is not being encultured, and that people of other ethnic groups or traditions, that they are the people who have culture and we're pretty neutral. But from what I've learned is that, you know, Western medicine is a culture of itself. Mm-hmm. And we, I think, can start taking a more critical look at our own behaviors, both in clinical encounters and our own belief systems, and recognize that we are bringing culture to the encounter also.
That, I mean, you can't help it. I mean, it's a lot like the bias work, like understanding and recognizing we all have biases. And if you think you don't, you are wrong. We all have them, but recognizing what those are. And so I think to at least now be able to think about it. So you're not obviously going to fix everything overnight, but to be aware now of cultural safety, thanks to you, but also just to pause and think about it, because we all want to do what's best for our patients and their families across the board. We do. And so if this will help us be a little bit better at providing good care that's effective, that also is safe and respectful, that's, I think, a really great goal. So,
yeah, I mean, it's so true. I mean, nobody goes through all of the training and all of the education that we have to do harm. In fact, we take an oath not to do harm. And so it's difficult and painful to, you know, recognize that we may inadvertently be doing harm. And I think that, you know, you're right. There's a lot of discussion now about equity and about removing barriers and leveling the playing field, so to speak. And, you know, I think about how, you know, could we be less medical culture in our approach to our patients, like start to question whether there's a way to maintain our professionality, but maybe step outside a little bit of some of our Western cultural norms so that we can meet our patients with what is more respect, but also feels to them like they are being more respected. And maybe take away some of that power dynamic that we're just not aware of. I think the longer you practice, the more we forget that, you know, it's a power dynamic. I know when I go to the doctor, I feel like there's a power dynamic, and I'm a physician. But as a patient, I feel I'm getting the short end of the stick as the patient. And so, yeah, how can we become more self-aware of what we're bringing to clinical encounters? so that we can create more safety. And as you mentioned in some of our discussions, how can we have shared decision making?
Yeah.
If we want to have shared decision making, then, you know, let's create an environment where our patients truly feel equals, because I think that is the basis of shared decision making, right? Is that we are coming to the encounter as equals.
Yes. So you each bring your own knowledge and experience to the table. You talk about it, and then together you make the decision that is best for that patient. And that may not be what I would prefer we do, or it may not be entirely what they were comfortable with. But after each discussing and being heard, you make that decision together.
Yeah. I mean, it is a really nice ideal. And I think, you know, as physicians, we're always trying to do better. And so it fits with this topic too. You know, we're always improving. We're always discarding our old practices that don't work as well. And keeping open to new ideas and new data. So I think this fits. One thing I think we should ask ourselves is whether it's ever appropriate to counsel families against a cultural practice, even if we think that it is for their own good. And that's what the issue around the hip dysplasia and the cradle boards brought up to me is, you know, is there ever a time when we should do that? And that if we find ourselves in that situation, we should think really hard about that.
Yeah, that is a very challenging thing to think about, but a really good question. Can you think of any examples of a situation in which you might really be wanting to advise somebody to go against a cultural belief?
Yeah, well, since I been thinking about these issues, I started to wonder about nutrition and how I think sometimes our culture can be a little judgmental about food choices. Mm-hmm. And I started to understand that there's a lot of cultural connection to food in a way in which counseling people on being, quote, healthier might actually come across as an assault on culture. And so, yeah, I think the more we think about this, the more we'll realize there might be ways in which we might be inadvertently assaulting someone's cultural identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing not all, because I know there's a lot more that you learned that you didn't share, but thank you for distilling it down and making it easier to understand why there are issues there and how we can try to improve and do a little bit better. So along the lines of asking questions, it's now the time of the podcast for a little game. Okay, so now it is time for a round of which would you choose? So, would you choose to spend the next year of your life in a library or spend the next year of your life in a museum?
Wow, that is a really good question. I think I would rather be in a museum, even though I like libraries and I like reading.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, especially if it's the Met. I think I could spend a year.
Yeah. Or natural history. I was like, oh, all those bones. And I could sleep there at night with the bones. That would be really cool.
Nice. All right. And then your final question is, would you choose either the only food you are allowed to eat will be picked by a 3-year-old or the only films and TV shows you are allowed to watch will be picked by a very strict nun?
That's kind of easy for me, actually, because I'm kind of picky about my food and I don't want someone else picking it for me, especially a 3-year-old. So I think I would go with the nun picking my media selection for me.
All right. And I actually am going to go with the opposite because I like to ask kids what their favorite foods are. And I mean, you hear a lot of chicken nuggets and mac and cheese, but I will tell you, I have had some very young kids tell me they like sushi or salmon or edamame, which is always fun hearing a 3-year-old pronounce edamame. So I'd be adventurous and go for the 3-year-old.
That's cool.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing. Really appreciate getting to sit down with you today.
Thanks. This was great. I appreciate you asking me.